How are you, folks? How many of you saw American Sniper out of curiosity? Like most of the country, and yet it won sound editing last night at the Oscars. That sounds about right. Hey, smile quick, because I'm going to tweet some pictures here after the event. How many of you are on Twitter? All right, time for most of you to pick up on that. At Chris Stigall, if you're not following, I hope you'll do so. I want to thank you very much for making the trip out here, because tonight is one of those nights that I've been saying it since we started booking this event with the Colonel. I hope to do a lot more learning and listening than I do talking, and I hope you've come with questions too. But as you know, we have been hearing some extraordinary things coming out of Washington, D.C. as it relates to this growing, and I'll say it, Islamic terrorist threat known as ISIS. Yet, it seems we're not capable of defining it out of Washington, D.C. Yet, it's still very, very present, and it's very, very deadly. And when I was introduced to Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel a few months ago, and I saw this ever-evolving barbarism, I thought, how could we not have an evening like this to pick the brain of one of the greatest military thinkers, I would say, in the country, and that he's right here in our own backyard and now headmaster of this fantastic facility, which, by the way, how about a hand for the Haverford School for hosting it tonight? The Colonel is the ninth headmaster in 130
years.
130 years. He's only number nine here, so it's a pretty prestigious gig. And for a very prestigious guy, in my view, please welcome to the stage, his own stage, Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel. Colonel? How about you? Did you see American Sniper?
I have not yet seen American
Sniper.
You
haven't seen it yet.
I have not seen
it. What about, you know, Clint Eastwood described his film as American Sniper. He said it was not really a pro-war film, that it was actually an anti-war film. It told the story of Chris Kyle and the ravages, frankly, war had on his life, his family's life. We know how his life tragically came to an end. Before we get into the meat and potatoes of the geopolitical fight that's going on today, talk to me about serving in combat, what that meant to you, leading men and women in combat, what that can do to men and women who return home, and as they see this unfolding, I guess a military point of view from people that have served in combat, your 30,000-foot view, if you could.
Sure. I served in two wars for America. I fought in Operation Desert Storm. I had a tank platoon in that war, a great little war. We took the Iraqi army from the fourth largest in the world to the second largest in Iraq in a period of just 100 hours. That was very, to the extent that war can be clean, that was clean war. It was, for us at least, it was antiseptic war. It was war fought from 30,000 feet, or in my case, from a tank. We were firing at targets from 500 meters away to 1,500 meters away. And so you never saw the faces of the people you killed. And that is the kind of war, frankly, that the United States would prefer to fight if it gets the chance. Unfortunately, the enemy gets a vote. And our enemies learned from Desert Storm that confronting the United States in conventional force-on-force combat means you're going to lose. And so they chose to fight us other ways, have chosen to fight us other ways, really since Desert Storm, since 1991. So I date the war against radical Islamic extremism. As Chris said, it is a war. We are fighting radical Islamic extremists. They started it in 1993 with the first bombing of the World Trade Center, and we tend to forget today how close that attack came to bringing the towers down, and it should have been more of a warning for us than it was. Of course, they succeeded 8 years later, and my second war, Operation Iraqi Freedom, in 2003 and 2004 in Al-Anbar, Iraq, in a very, very different kind of war from my first war. We fought at very close range. We fought an enemy who made himself invisible to us. To use Mao's phrase, our enemies were fish swimming in the sea of the people. They were insurgents and terrorists. We couldn't identify who the enemy was. When we figured out who he was, it was comparatively easy to remove him from the battlefield. But that kind of war is very different from the Desert Storm kind of war, and it grinds on you in a very different way. And of course, Desert Storm, start to finish, not much more than 6 months. The war in Iraq, my second war in Iraq, Operation Iraqi Freedom, 8 years, the first go-around, and we're back in it again. And guys went back and forth over and over again, and this is what happened to Chris Kyle. But also, he killed people from shorter ranges than I had in Desert Storm, but got to know them intimately through the power of optics. And there is only what we have learned about warfare over it's the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War this year. In the Civil War, post-traumatic stress was called soldier's heart. Your heart was affected. And the name has changed. During the First World War, it was shell shock. In World War II, it was battle fatigue. We now call it post-traumatic stress disorder or post-traumatic stress syndrome. It is an injury. There is only so much any man can take, or any woman can take, for that matter. And on this stage just last week, I had David Finkel speak in a lecture we give every year. Finkel, Pulitzer Prize winner, writes for The Post, has written two wonderful books. One of them, The Good Soldiers, about 216 infantry out of Fort Riley, Kansas, which went to Iraq during the surge and fought very hard. And the second, even more powerful book, Thank You for Your Service, talks about what happens to those guys when they came home. And can I tell one quick story?
Please.
One of the stories David tells in that second book is the story of a phenomenal soldier on his third combat tour in Iraq, and a kid got sniped by their version of Chris Kyle, one of their snipers, and the soldier was hit in the head, and it was a narrow Iraqi building. They couldn't put the kid on a stretcher. He was a big kid. They couldn't put him on a stretcher and carry him down, and this sergeant, God bless him, picked the kid up, and firemen's carried him down three flights of stairs. But the geometry of the wound was such that blood from the head wound ran through his mouth while he was carrying his buddy downstairs. And that was it for him. He 6 months later, he was still tasting the blood, and he suffered just horribly as a result. So there is only so much any person can take. And one of the things we need to be conscious of as a nation is that when we ask our sons and daughters to go and fight these wars, we shouldn't just pay the costs of the wars as they're happening. We have to understand that we're going to be taking care of those who took care of us for generations to come. And we have to be prepared to make that commitment to them and to their families, to, as Abraham Lincoln said, care for he who has borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan. That's a sacred trust, and we're not doing as much as we should on that front.
And on that front, I'd ask you quickly, I know I'm going back to sort of an old story, although it shouldn't be old, it should be white hot constantly, the VA scandal. Can you speak to that? I hear very conflicting reports from my father-in-law, for instance, is a Army combat pilot in Vietnam, and he uses VA services in Chicago. Seems pretty satisfied on the whole. I don't hear universal criticism of the VA system, but where I hear it, I hear it's quite poor. So can you speak to that?
So the VA actually became pretty good at taking care of the World War II generation and the Vietnam generation. They were not ready. The nation was not ready for the injuries we've suffered in our two most recent wars, now both still ongoing in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we expected them to be short wars, unwisely, incorrectly. We did not prepare for long wars. We did not increase the size of the army, so just a few soldiers had to fight over and over and over again. And we did not prepare the VA for the onslaught of wounds it was going to be facing, in many cases, horrific wounds. Soldiers who would certainly have died in Vietnam or in earlier wars, we're keeping alive now. It's an extraordinary blessing in medical technology, and we've got some docs in the room. Medical technology has advanced so much that we would have two or three times the number of killed if this war had been being fought 20 years ago. But those wounded veterans require extraordinary medical resources, and the VA simply wasn't ready for that. And so this is all part of, I think, one of the critical mistakes of the last administration, not mobilizing the nation for war after September 11th, and not getting ready for what is clearly a multi-generational fight against radical Islamic extremism.
You know what I value so much about Colonel Noggle is, and you'll hear this throughout, and you've already heard it twice, you're not blindly partisan, you're not blindly loyal to an administration, you're able to critically think and analyze and look at two commanders-in-chief and see where they've made strategic errors or miscalculations or what have you, and so I value that as we go forward. I just want you to know that we're going to work awfully hard to keep it that way in this conversation, because I think combat is a more serious thing than politics, generally speaking. I do think people frame the debate and the argument in different ways, and I will get into that a bit, but may I ask quickly, show of hands, how many of you are former or current members of the military yourselves? Show a hand. That's fantastic. How about a hand for these fine folks that showed up tonight? Thank you. And I know, I'm sure a lot of you will have questions for the colonel, so let me dive right into a couple of things. One, John McCain, kind of out of left field over the weekend, this is unrelated to ISIS and the current threat that we're facing there in the Middle East, but he said something quite remarkable. Even Bob Schieffer was taken aback. I don't know if you heard it or not, but yesterday on the Sunday shows, John McCain said, and I quote, he was ashamed of himself, he was ashamed of the president, and he was ashamed of the country for our, boiling it down, lack of response in dealing with Russia in the Ukraine. Can you respond to that statement from a guy that I don't think anybody questions? I mean, if you want to talk about questioning someone's patriotism, it's pretty hard to do so with John McCain.
So John McCain is a great American. I've gotten to spend some time with him over the years. I have enormous respect, obviously, for his service in Vietnam, his service in the Senate, his continued leadership, and in particular on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and I'm hoping he can get some things done. All that said, I think he's wrong on the Ukraine. The Ukraine is a vital national interest for Russia. It is not a vital national interest for the United States. And I'm a political scientist when I'm not a headmaster. I'm a recovering political scientist. It's a 12-step program. All right, but in political science, we have something called a theory called escalation dominance. And that means if I go higher, the other guy can go higher still. And the Ukraine is so much more important to Russia than it is to us, and so much closer to Russia than it is to us. That I actually think, and I'm, as you noted, I'm equal opportunity. I'm critical of both sides. I'm trying to make sure that I stay at the Haverford School forever by guaranteeing that I never work in either flavor of administration ever again by being critical of both. This is one of the places where I think the Obama administration has actually conducted its foreign policy reasonably well. So we should let Russia know that NATO is NATO, and they will go no further than NATO. They will go no further than the influence they have over the Ukraine, but we will secure NATO as we have promised, but we should not fight Russia in the Ukraine. What we have done in the Ukraine very successfully, and we've been fortunate, we've been aided by the biggest geopolitical change since the rise of radical Islamic extremism, and maybe since the end of the Soviet Union. It's too soon to tell yet how important fracking is. But the change in world oil prices as a result of fracking, a process invented in the United States and done very, very well and very effectively here, Russia is under enormous pressure. And it's worth just quickly noting that Russia, the life expectancy for a Russian male is 61 and falling. Primary cause of death is alcoholism and complications of alcoholism. And Russia's economy has been crushed by sanctions and by the fall in oil prices. Three quarters of Russia's income comes from oil, and oil prices have been cut in half over the last year and a half or so. So Russia is under enormous pressure. That doesn't mean it isn't dangerous, but it is not a threat to the United States at present. It is certainly not, and its actions in the Ukraine are not a vital national threat to the United States. You're going to learn, if you stay with me here, pretty much of a peacenik. I'm not a big fan of wars, except for the wars that we absolutely have to fight, and the war against radical Islamic extremism is one of those. War with Russia over Ukraine is not.
I have a lot of questions, as I know you all do too, but generally speaking, from a 30,000-foot view, it's kind of where I always like to start with things like this. This thing called ISIS, The president calls it ISIL. I still get questions, and I still don't really know how to answer it, and I think you have answered it before. There's that component. There's the Muslim Brotherhood. There's Boko Haram. There's Al-Qaeda. You know, 9/11 hijackers and those that killed 3,000 Americans were largely Saudi. You know, Boko Haram is largely Nigerian.
Yep.
I don't, you know, what is your 30,000-foot view, perspective, on what is this terrorist threat that faces the rest of the free globe?
There's no easy answer for that. It's an important question that we don't talk about enough. There's a very good piece in the Atlantic Monthly analyzing the Islamic State and pointing out what it wants. All of these groups struggle with modernity and the challenges modernity presents to a very deeply held set of core beliefs they have. Beliefs are rooted in a very radical fundamentalist view of Sharia, of Islamic law, and modernity challenges those views.
And so, Colonel, may I, on that point, may I just say then, is it fair to say all those groups, all those entities that I mentioned, the thing linking them together is that fundamentalism, that religious component?
Almost all of them, almost all of the time. So, unfortunately, nothing in international politics is ever simple, but certainly Al-Qaeda, which arose from the Mujahideen we funded in the 1980s to overthrow and defeat the Soviet Union inside Afghanistan after their invasion. Al-Qaeda sprang from those Mujahideen and grew in Egyptian prisons. And one of the interesting things that we as Americans need to think about is that a number of our so-called allies, Egypt, Saudi Arabia among them, have fomented these radical Islamic regimes and ideas. And so an awful lot of Al-Qaeda's thinking developed in Egyptian prisons, right? As Egypt imprisoned radicals and they became even more radicalized in prison.
Which, to that point, I hate to interrupt you, but just that there were governments in place. That's why with all the successive topplings of these regimes and these various, you know, what seemed to be kind of small outlying countries from Libya to Egypt over the last few years, the Arab Spring, that's consequential in that while those were dictators, they still kept this radicalism at bay, didn't they? They kept that genie in the bottle.
And this is one of the reasons why the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was such a mistake. Saddam Hussein was a really, really bad guy, but he kept Al-Qaeda out of Iraq. There was no AQ in Iraq before we invaded in 2003. It came afterwards. Saddam would have killed them, right? He ran a police state. Egypt ran a police state that kept Al-Qaeda off the streets. The Muslim Brotherhood is not doing so. Qaddafi in Libya, similarly. So, right, Americans and American foreign policy struggles with the conflict between realism and idealism, our interests and our values. And we are fairly unique in the world in that conflict, in that struggle, that internal struggle, because the rest of the world bases its foreign policy purely on its interests. We also account for our values, and there's often a struggle between those. But for many years, we supported regimes that were very repressive. The Egyptian regime is one. The Saudi regime is one we're continuing to support. And there are costs and consequences associated with that. When they oppress their own people, when they don't allow political freedom, when, as a combination of many different factors, the Arab world as a whole is in a horrific hole. There are no automobiles produced in the entire Arab-speaking world. There are more books published in Danish every year, a language spoken by 25 million people, than there are in Arabic, the primary language of 500 million people. And so the intellectual wasteland that is Islam, the Arabic world, the combination of the Arabic world and Islam is an unfortunate breeding ground for radical extremists. They don't have good education systems. They don't have really access to any kind of route out. And way too many of their young people attend their boys, because the girls don't go to school, which doesn't help. But the boys attend madrasas where they memorize the Quran. And there's nothing particularly wrong with memorizing the Quran, but it's sort of like memorizing the Bible. It's impressive. It can help you in some ways. It's not going to be particularly effective at getting you a job or giving you a successful career. And so these boys become men with no skills and really no hope, and they are prime recruiting ground then for radical extremists.
And so, Colonel, if I have a member of Boko Haram standing on this stage and a member of ISIS and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, they would high-five one another and say, yeah, we're all on the same page?
They would certainly all agree that Islam is the revealed truth. They would... the Muslim Brotherhood, I think, and ISIS would agree that one of the goals, that one of their primary goals, is the restoration of the caliphate. In the 7th century, Islam ruled a very substantial swath of northern Africa, extending and the Middle East, extending all the way up into Europe. And the avowed goal of Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda's successor organization, ISIS, the Islamic State, is to recreate that caliphate and to impose radical Sharia law over that entire swath of territory.
A caliphate is the desired objective of Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Muslim Brotherhood.
I won't put Boko Haram in that same category completely. There's some nationalism there as well and just some raw desire for political power. I don't think they'd object.
Is there any division that can be exploited strategically between these factions of radical Islam?
There is. The problem we have right now, we really had Al-Qaeda on the run, on the ropes, and damn near on the mat after the killing, the long overdue killing of Osama bin Laden, the relative success of the surge in Iraq. Al-Qaeda by 2010, 2011 was in real trouble. One of the really critical errors this administration made was pulling all American troops out of Iraq at the end of 2011, a decision that was not supported by me, Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, Director of the Central Intelligence Agency Leon Panetta, CENTCOM Commander David Petraeus. None of them thought that was a good idea. The president made the decision to do it anyway. That gave space for the Islamic State to grow. So the Islamic State, we had pushed Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which I fought against in 2004 in Al-Anbar. We had pushed them out of Iraq and into Syria, where they became part of a number of insurgencies against President Assad of Syria. Also not a good guy, but not as bad as ISIS, and we may come back to that later. The combination of failing to arm the moderate rebels, the so-called Free Syrian Army, another Obama administration decision in the summer of 2012, coupled with pulling all the American troops out of the western, all of Iraq, but in particular the western part of Iraq, gave room for the renamed Al-Qaeda in Iraq, now relabeled the Islamic State, to grow and to take over territory. And the Islamic State currently has territory the size of the United Kingdom. It is the biggest, most powerful terror organization in human history. That has happened over the last, since the end of 2011, right, over the last 4 years.
So right? Not JV.
This is not the JV team. This is a real problem. And the reason it's a problem is not just the territory they own, but wars are like football games in lots and lots of ways, but one of them is that you have momentum. And the Islamic State has momentum. It has a very powerful brand right now. The success it has achieved has resounded across the world of jihadis.
And I asked you on the show not long ago that the president said during the State of the Union that this was more or less something that was in its last throes. It's a desperate movement, that their behavior on film is the act of a desperate movement. You fundamentally disagree.
I fundamentally disagree. And so... The president has correctly stated in the past that our objective is to defeat and ultimately to destroy the Islamic State. I completely agree with that. He has said that the Islamic State presents a threat to our friends and to us, and I agree with that. I therefore think that where the president and I disagree on ISIS is, I think we ought to be taking this threat really damn seriously. And every day that we don't, every day that they continue to hold territory the size of the United Kingdom, every day that they continue to own the airwaves and the internets, every day that they continue to radicalize people around the globe, including in the United States, every day that they continue to attract Western passport holders to join the jihad, to join the winning team, and there are thousands, literally thousands of Western passport holders currently training and operating with the Islamic State inside Iraq and Syria, and those people are not going to go away. They are going to become the seed corn for the next generation of jihadis as they use their passports to go all over the globe. We need to stop these guys. We need to stop them now, yesterday. And we are not taking this threat seriously enough.
It got a lot of laughs, including from me. As I hear you talk, I think a little bit more about it is worthy of entertaining, because obviously the whole landscape of everything we do in life has changed with the advent of technology and social media. It seems laughable, and I think largely it still is on its face, that this is a movement that's just desperate for economic stimulus or jobs, or if only we could take them out on Twitter. The New York Times, I just noted this, the New York Times reported that the Obama administration is preparing to use more than 350 State Department Twitter accounts to combat a digital footprint. Now, I must admit, I read that coming in here today, and I kind of laughed at it, but as I hear you talk, you got to squash them like bugs. You have to, physically. I believe that in my heart. I don't know about you, but there is a component of recruitment that we've never seen before, and I suppose you do have to figure out how to deal with that.
One of the things that I'm proudest of in my life, it was my work on the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Manual. I was part of a team led by General David Petraeus of the Army, General Jim Mattis of the United States Marine Corps, and we over the course of the year, calendar year 2006, we started in November 2005, finished in December 2006, we wrote the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual, and just briefly published on December 15th, 2006, downloaded 1.5 million times in the next month, translated and critiqued on jihadi websites, copies found in Taliban training camps in Pakistan. So our enemies were reading it. We had to get our guys to read it, right? And the process of getting our guys to read it included getting it published by the University of Chicago Press and me taking it aboard The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. True story, where I had the funniest discussion Jon Stewart has ever had on camera about an Army field manual. But there's very, very serious stuff in the book, and it says that there are six lines of operation when defeating an insurgency, and radical Islamic extremism is an insurgency, right? It's a global insurgency, and so it takes global counterinsurgency to defeat it, and that's combat operations against the enemy whenever you can, wherever you can. And we need to emphasize that first, and this is one of the problems I have with some of the stuff that the administration has been saying. They've been talking, or appearing to talk, about a bloodless war, and they are uncomfortable with the use of force in international politics, and believe that force is not the answer to every problem. And I agree with that. But there are some problems for which it is the only answer. And killing radical Islamic extremists, force is the way to do that, and we need to kill them every chance we have and do that first.
There right. have to be bombs. There has to be
there have to be bombs.
Kabooms, guns.
There have to be bombs, and there have to be boots on the ground, American boots on the ground, accompanying the second logical line of operation in a counterinsurgency campaign, host nation security forces. So the Iraqi troops and the Kurdish troops are going to be the ones who do most of the killing, but they're going to need American combat advisors embedded in their units. American boots on the ground, designating targets with lasers, calling in airstrikes, right? Facing artillery fire, getting hurt, getting killed. It is going to cost American blood to push the Islamic State out of Iraq.
And you're the guy that said we didn't belong in Iraq to begin with.
But once we went in, once we removed Saddam Hussein, who was a bad guy, right? But he kept the lid on everything else. We created, if there has been a basic principle of American national security policy since September 11th, it has been never again give the bad guys a base in which they can plan and prepare for and from which they can conduct attacks on the United States and our friends around the globe. That's why we invaded Afghanistan in 2001 correctly. We should have finished the job, stayed in Afghanistan, and I'm a Jesuit-trained St. Augustine. The only purpose of a war is to build a better peace. We failed to build that better peace in Afghanistan. If you look, the end of Charlie Wilson's war, right? The wonderful Naval Academy member of Congress, Charlie Wilson, the extraordinary things he accomplished, defeating the Soviet Union, really ending the Cold War in Afghanistan, right? At a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, but we failed to invest a few million afterwards to build a stable Afghanistan. The Taliban came to power, they gave a home to bin Laden. You know the rest of the story, right? We shouldn't have invaded Iraq in 2003. It had no connection to September 11th, no connection to Al-Qaeda, right? But once we did, it suddenly became a magnet for Al-Qaeda. And at that point, it becomes our responsibility to the American people, to protect the American people, to keep Al-Qaeda out of Iraq. We went away, they came back in. We need to push them out and then keep them out with a long-term American presence in Iraq, just as we've had a long-term American presence in Germany, Italy, Japan, South Korea, the former Yugoslavia. That's what we do.
So 9/11 was a point where you agree, we needed to go to Iraq. We needed to flush out
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
Yes, absolutely.
Iraq was the component you disagreed with.
Correct.
In Iraq it became the hornet's nest where everybody flooded that there was of this ideology, we're going to go there and take the fight to the West in Iraq. And that's presently where you still see it more or less residing today.
There is no doubt that the Islamic State is the biggest terror threat in the world. It has replaced Al-Qaeda Central. We have decimated Al-Qaeda Central inside Pakistan on the Pakistan-Afghan border. But the Islamic State is so successful and it is so powerful on the internet, right, on the interweb, that it is creating splinter groups. And people like Boko Haram, who have completely different agendas, are saying, we're part of ISIS too, to try to get some of the money that's flowing to ISIS, largely from Saudi Arabia. Right? So the brand name of ISIS is the hottest thing going in international jihad right now. We need to hit them in the nose, demonstrate that they're vulnerable, and reverse that tide of momentum to dry up not just the information as you're talking about, and I agree with that, but also the money. And so the other lines of operation and counterinsurgency campaign quickly are economics and building good government and providing essential services to the population, and most importantly, information. And this battle of the narrative, we're currently losing. It's going to take more than Twitter accounts to win the battle of the narrative. We have to change the reality on the ground in Iraq. So I don't mind some Twitterers, but I want some boots on the ground.
What is the... I don't think I've been kind of more jaw agape. I mean, obviously the president's politics, I don't agree with on much of anything. But when the man said Christians ought not be on their high horse about ISIS and these fundamentalists, that to me was a pivot point. That sent a message to me. He referenced American history and Christianity and the Crusades and saying Christianity was once justified as a reason to do awful things. That instantly put Americans and Christians on equal footing historically with what we're seeing today. In my view, do you view it that way? And what does that mean coming from the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces?
President Obama is a really smart guy. Who he is. Harvard Law, I mean, he's smart, and I've spent some time with him. He's smart.
You served in his administration, by the way, for people that don't know.
Well, only in uniform. But not as a political appointee, but he's really smart. He has a basic discomfort with the use of force in international politics and doesn't understand, I don't think, at an intuitive level, something that George W. Bush, for all his failings, understood very, very well, that there are enemies in the world and that they need to be killed. And there is no moral equivalence, right? This is not a law classroom, right? The world is not a law classroom. There are bad people in the world who do horrible things, and it is the job of the American military to kill them, and they are happy to do that. There's a wonderful Bible verse, and I don't know which book it comes from right now, but the verse, it's an Old Testament verse. If the commander sounds an uncertain trumpet, none will follow. And we have had an uncertain trumpet from this administration, in particular in this third war in Iraq in my lifetime, and there's a real more than a reluctance, an inability to come to terms with the fact. George W. Bush loved being a war president. He probably loved it too much. This president really doesn't want to be a war president, but there's a war here, and it needs fighting.
If you could boil it down, I mean, really, the caricature of the both of them, Bush was the cowboy, Obama's the academic. And you say there was too much of both of them.
I think both of those caricatures are correct to a certain extent, and neither were exactly what we needed. There is a role for force in international politics, but it is not the only weapon we need. We need diplomacy, we need the Twitterers, we need economic development, but the pendulum overswung in the other direction, and it's my strong hope and belief that it centers itself in 2016, and that we get a president who understands that force is not the only answer, but sometimes force is absolutely necessary.
There is a very strong component among, I guess if you want to call it the Republican voter, or we're going to go to CPAC this week and cover that. And there will be a large faction of self-identified, I guess if you want to call them libertarians, who traditionally, and I don't want to speak for them, I don't count myself as one, but they would say at no point would they support any physical boots on the ground, any kind of intervention physically. They would prefer, I think, more reliance on our own for our own energy needs, that we become less dependent on the Saudis, that we become almost able to unplug from our need for the Middle East at all and just let the cesspool flush itself out. We'll be fine as long as we just leave them be. And you would, I don't know if I've, maybe there's some libertarians in the audience that can take this in a little while, but that I think I've boiled it down as the way they'd see it.
I don't think that's unfair. The Cato Institute is Chris Preble, a friend of mine at Cato, and I have debated some of these issues in the past. The problem is that it doesn't stay there. So what we learned on September 11th is that we should have learned in 1993 with the first bombing of the World Trade Center, is that this pernicious evil that is radical Islamic extremism will hunt us down and hurt us here. And the oceans don't protect us in this century. They can reach out over the internet and radicalize people as they have successfully in Ottawa. And so if we don't deal with it over there, it will come here. And there will come a point, the pain level will rise to a point where even the libertarians say, enough is enough. My answer is, we've already passed that point.
Fundamentalists are just rebelling against the modernity of the West. And if we Westerners would just butt out and keep our modern culture out, if we would just leave these people be to govern themselves and rule themselves under Sharia the way they wish to be governed and not impose our Western ideals on them, we'll be fine.
No is the short answer. The long answer is that, of course, just as we cannot build walls to protect us from this threat, they cannot keep out the things that they fear and they hate about the modern world. And it is true that they object to the modern world. There's a wonderful now 20-year-old book by Tom Friedman, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, which talks about the struggle between modernity and ancient traditions and tribalism and the desire to hold on to your olive tree. And he uses the olive tree and its deep roots and its ancient gnarled form and contrasts it with a Lexus, the essence, he says, of modernity. And the book is still, 20 years later, worth reading. The pull of modernity is very powerful, but there is an inability in a world where learning is not encouraged, where there is no hope of a brighter future, really, for way too many of the young people of the Islamic world, and in particular of the Arab world, and they are easy prey for, too many of them are easy prey for radical preachers, radical thinkers, many of them educated in jihad inside the prisons of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, to become weapons to be used against the West.
Well, and if I may on that point, I mean, this is the very thing that the administration in the last couple of weeks has been hammering. Biden said, I just noted this evening. Biden said, we need answers that go beyond force. Marie Harf, we know, talked about the need for jobs, and they want economic answers. Obama told religious leaders at the White House, Islamic religious leaders, hey, you know, the problem is your stuff's boring, and their stuff's so much sexier online. Is that not their idea of Western modernity being imposed on those people now? I mean, is that their solution seems to fly in the face of what a lot of people on the political left would say, that it's not our business, leave them alone, let's not influence or force our way of life on them. Yet that seems to be what I'm hearing the Obama administration say we ought to do.
Our way of life, they cannot escape from our way of life or from the successes, the extraordinary successes of the global economy, of the internet and American invention, and the information that it brings. And we talked a little bit earlier about the Arab Spring and the pressures on many of these repressive regimes, which have fallen because of the ready access of information. They can no longer pretend, keep from their people, the fact that they are falling further and further behind. And so the idea that we are imposing this idea on them, it's impossible for them not to be bathed by it, and for many of them will inevitably resent it, and some percentage of those people are likely to fall prey to radical preachers, to radical imams. And so some of this, much of this, most of this work does have to be done inside the Islamic world, which does need to build education, create jobs, allow opportunities for women. All of those things need to happen, but that's going to take generations. We also need to, while that is happening and while we are encouraging that, and there's nothing wrong with doing that, but we need to use military force. Military force is not the only answer, but it's the answer for a big part of this problem. In particular, it's the answer for blunting the momentum of ISIS and defeating the narrative that is currently allowing them to recruit fighters and raise money on the internet because of their extraordinary successes.
In short order, we will crush you like bugs if you don't stop. Long ball, we've got to change the cultural thinking.
Correct. So there are tactical and operational things we need to do on the ground in Iraq right now with American boots. And there are strategic things we need that need to happen, grand strategic things that need to happen, society reshaping. And that needs to be done by the Muslims. You're absolutely right. But we can encourage them. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, and we need to kill them where they have taken territory, where we have a government that we want to rule that territory, and we have a partner to partner with. The real essence of the problem is not Iraq, it's Syria.
Yeah.
That's where this problem gets really hard, whenever you want to go there for a real fun time.
Well, and that's, you know, there seems to be a sincere desire for a lot of us to not castigate an entire people, you know, not prejudge everyone that identifies with Islam or that is Muslim. We're desperate not to put all Muslims or all practitioners of Islam into a box and say you are all beholden to this terrorism. So I'll ask then, in your view, who are our even loose or soft friends, if you will? I mean, you see George W. Bush, and then the president made extraordinary efforts to go be a part of the Saudi king's funeral. So you've got Jordan, you've got Saudi Arabia. Who else? I mean, who are our friends? Where is the modern Muslim world in aiding this, what will have to be a culture shift down the road?
And so let me start by applauding the first thing you said. So I fought alongside a number of very brave Iraqi soldiers, Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds, helped train them, saw them die, had them stand watch with me over the bodies of their fallen and my fallen. So Muslims, the vast majority of Muslims, 99.9-something, right, digits continue, of Muslims are as repelled and abhor this senseless violence, which is mostly killing Muslims, right? The radical Islamists are mostly killing other Muslims, right, including the Jordanian pilot they burned alive.
21 Egyptians.
Including apparently the 40 Anbarians, Sunni Muslims from Al-Anbar who they burned alive yesterday or the day before.
Yeah.
So they are mostly killing other Muslims, right? And this goes to the narrative, right? The entire Islamic, moderate Islamic world should be casting unbelievable scorn and derision on these people who kill their fellow religious believers who worship the same God, right? And that's enormously that will be enormously powerful if we can ever get that going, right? So the vast majority of them want the same things we do.
Believe
a different God. Go ahead.
I don't want to interrupt your train of thought because I want you to pivot to that next point, but just as a follow-up, I know there are people in this audience that feel this way. I get these calls. They fundamentally believe it's in their book. These are the preachings. These are the teachings. This is Islam. And at its root, at its down and dirty, honest root, their book says it. Kill or convert. And they're just, I'll be honest, I'm not a Quran reader. Haven't done it. Maybe I should, because it seems to come up a lot. But people that have are just very confident that this really is, at its root, their faith, that it drives everything that happens.
So it is certainly worth your time to read the Quran. There are passages in the Quran that would curl your hair if you had any.
Well done.
And I won't do any moral equivalents, but there are passages in pretty much every religious book, every religious text that will curl your hair. But the Muslims I have fought with, right? I have not bled. I've been lucky. They missed. But the Muslims who have bled with me while I've been fighting have wanted the same things I have wanted. They have fought for their country. They have fought for freedom for their country and safety for their children. And so, right, all Muslims I know are not dedicated to jihad, dedicated to the overthrow of the West, dedicated to the restoration of the caliphate. A very small percentage are. Unfortunately, there are a billion Muslims in the world, and so a small percentage is still a big problem. And it's interesting, right? We've got actually somebody who wrote a wonderful book on Islam and did comparative work among different Islamic countries. Indonesia, the biggest Muslim country in the world, has next to no jihadi problem. Right, so there are national as well as religious issues involved here. There he is, Dory Friend. Ladies and gentlemen, Dory Friend, student of the subject. He'll tell me later how I did in answering your good question. But thanks, Dory. But the ones who do believe this need to be killed, and we need to be really open about that. And some of them can be converted, but most of them need to be killed. And the sooner we get to work doing that in Iraq, the fewer of them there will be to kill. And this is my biggest and most fundamental problem. There's an unwillingness, I think, to say that part in the administration. There's an unwillingness to provide the resources to do that are required in Iraq.
This thing, ISIS or ISIL, where did that come from? You're saying we drove that entity out of Iraq in our initial invasion, or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. We successfully drove it out. They regrouped, they reorganized. We kind of thought of them as Al-Qaeda, even though I don't know that they were what you labeled them. But I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I try to follow this stuff. Until maybe about 2 years ago, I'd never heard the term ISIS. Where did it come from?
So you really need a scorecard, right, and maps to keep track. So Al-Qaeda Central started in Egypt, I would say, started in the prisons of Egypt, was given enormous support inside Saudi Arabia, and attracted Osama bin Laden, who became its leader, found a home in the Afghan-Pakistan borderlands and that became Al-Qaeda Central and the base. We have essentially defeated, if not destroyed, Al-Qaeda Central. And that is an extraordinary accomplishment for which we should all be, of which we should be proud,
and
for which we should be grateful.
Their leader was Osama bin Laden.
Their leader was Osama bin Laden, and he is fish food, and the world is better for that. But its ideology, the ideas, became very powerful and spread. And when we invaded Iraq in 2003 and toppled Saddam Hussein without a plan to replace him, right, disorder is not even the right word for it. And there was anarchy in Iraq, and the cause celeb for jihad, the world's radical Muslims flocked to Iraq to fight the United States and to fight the Shia-dominated government of Iraq. The Al-Qaeda, largely a Sunni, almost exclusively a Sunni organization. And they a new branch of Al-Qaeda was created called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or AQI. And I was fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2004. I was fighting both local Sunni insurgents who were largely defending their homeland, but I was also fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq, largely foreigners, much more sophisticated, lots more money, much more impressive weapons. And we fought with both organizations really until 2007. In 2007, in the pivotal event of the second Iraq war of my lifetime, the Sunni Arabs flipped in what's called the Sawa, or the Awakening. They stopped fighting against us with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they started fighting against AQI. They started fighting with us. It was an extraordinary reversal.
Why?
Well, that's a...
Too big?
There's no clean way to say how horrible this ideology is, and nobody wants to live under Sharia law, right, including Sunni Arabs. So Al-Qaeda in Iraq would conduct forced marriages. They would go to tribal leaders and take their prettiest daughters, and they would become forced marriages. They would become Islamic war brides for the Al-Qaeda in Iraq fighters. They would cut the fingers off of anyone they caught smoking. These are the people who banned music and kite flying in Afghanistan. So the rules they impose, life under these guys is horrible, and ultimately the Sunni Arabs who of Al-Anbar province of Western Iraq, who are longtime smugglers and smokers, and they enjoy pretty much every vice we do. Chris does. I'm the headmaster of a boys' school. I don't actually have any vices, right? But they live the same life Chris does. They got tired of it and they flipped and they started fighting against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they pushed him out of Iraq and into Syria. And this was a good thing, except for Syria, right? Syria ruled by President Assad, another of the repressive leaders whom we have supported. But that inspires upset in the information world. I talked about a little bit about the Arab Spring. So in another example of the Arab Spring, instance of the Arab Spring, there were rebellions against Assad in Syria.
But again, he was a guy, much like in Egypt and in Libya. Assad was a guy, for as bad a guy as he is, he kept the wackos in check.
Correct, with his thugs.
With his own thugs.
At some very basic level, this is a struggle between wackos and thugs, right? And the problem with the wackos, if they are inspired by radical Islamic jihadi ideas, they are real wackos. And they will kill everybody who gets in their way. And Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had been all but eradicated, we pushed into Syria. It became Al-Qaeda in Syria, right? And at that point, the Al-Qaeda brand was so damaged.
They literally opened under
new management.
And called it ISIS.
And called it the Islamic State in Syria. And then last year they spread into Iraq very, very rapidly and became the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. So it's Al-Qaeda under new management. Same ideas, same desire to create the caliphate, the Islamic State, across all the same territory, but now based in Syria and Iraq, rather than on the Afghan-Pakistani borders. And it's much, much worse to have them in Iraq and Syria than it is to have them in the hinterlands of Pakistan.
And so what's the ISIL distinction with the president? He won't say ISIS, he says ISIL.
This is the L stands for the Levant. It's an ancient name for Syria and for this part of the world. I'm a historian.
Were any of you wondering that, by the way? Do any of you wonder that? Why ISIL versus ISIS? Maybe you know, and I didn't really.
I'm a historian. If we want to call that whole region the Levant, but then ISIL makes sense. But we don't, so I stick with ISIS. And
so it's an academic distinction.
It's a purely academic distinction.
Which makes sense.
That's on help.
I'm saying that's what you said about the guy. He's all academic.
He is a wonderful law professor.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the audience? Because I do want to. First of all, how fantastic is Colonel John Nagel? I think.
I've got a mic over here.
Okay. He's doing the Phil Donahue thing.
You like that? Actually, you'd mentioned libertarians.
How about that reference from 1980? Phil Donahue. Sorry, could I have done something more current? Ricky Lake?
He had hair. But so you'd ask about libertarians. As a libertarian, I think my problem is they said, hey, we should arm these guys. They're fighting Russia. Let's arm those guys. And then those are the guns that come back on us. Hey, we should arm those guys in Syria. The only way we seem to know when we were right is when we look back. I think that's the libertarian problem, and I don't know if you can address...
Arming, and he would say to the Charlie Wilson's war thing, which is something I brought up, the narrative of that movie was we armed these rebels, they helped beat the Russians at the time, who were our kind of our sworn enemy, and then it came back to bite us later, that they used our very weaponry against us later on, years later. I guess that... Is that fair?
And I think we could have prevented that, or certainly mitigated it, by building a better state in Afghanistan. And it's worth pointing out that the Afghan government that the Russians installed, the Soviets installed, didn't fall when the Russians departed. It held on for 3 years. It fell when the Soviet Union collapsed and was no longer paying the bills. And there's a really important lesson for us as we contemplate pulling out of Afghanistan, because, ladies and gentlemen, right, I think we disagree on this point. I'm enormously jealous of your facial hair, but not of your logic, right? What we want Afghanistan to be stable. We want the Afghan government to hold on to and control what happens inside its borders. And it's worth stationing American soldiers there, and if necessary, continuing to spill American blood in Afghanistan to prevent Afghanistan from again becoming a base for terror. And perhaps even more importantly, to keep American bases in Afghanistan in order to keep an eye on Pakistan and to have helicopters ready to go into Pakistan just in case the really, really, really bad happens. All right, so we've been talking a bunch about ISIS, but the most dangerous threat for the United States and the world is not a terror group. It's a country named Pakistan. A country that has the fourth or fifth largest nuclear arsenal in the world, the most rapidly growing nuclear arsenal in the world, the worst proliferator of nuclear weapons technology in the world, including to North Korea and some years ago to Syria, right? And is afflicted by a number of insurgencies, including some inside its own government institutions, including its own military, which has control of those nuclear weapons. And so it is hugely worth keeping American troops in Afghanistan forever to have American bases and American helicopters and American men who wear beards, actually much better beards than that, ready to do what needs doing if any of those nukes get loose.
What about, one last thing I meant to ask you. Iran is something we haven't discussed at all, and Iran is the one we seem to talk most about wanting to wipe Israel off the map. Wanting to acquire nuclear weaponry. You said that Pakistan is the most present threat, but what about Iran, and are they not as invested in seeing... Although Iran is also another one of these countries that squashes the wackos, aren't they?
Iran does squash the wackos, to use the technical international relations term.
Thugs and wackos. I like boiling it down to thugs and wackos.
Thugs and wackos works.
We're pro-thug than pro-wacko on the whole.
On the whole, I think that's accurate. Yeah. Unfortunately, those are often the only two choices. So Iran is also complicated. The Iranians are not Arab. They are Persian. It's a very different civilization. It's a much more ancient civilization and a much more... had a much greater positive influence on society. Algebra originated in Persia, and the Saudi Arabia and Iran are actually a really interesting comparison, because in Iran we hate the government, but the people are actually very pro-American. If we were able to get rid of the Iranian government and if we were able to have true democracy in Iran, the government that the Iranian people would elect would be strongly pro-American and strongly in our interests. And I actually believe that Iran is a long-term ally of the United States. Saudi Arabia is the opposite. The Saudi Arabian people, by and large, are strongly Islamist, are dedicated to the idea of the caliphate, and are the primary funders of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. 15 of the 19 September 11th hijackers were Saudi citizens.
That's the thing we forget, I think, a lot in this discussion. It was Saudis that struck Americans in the most deadly of ways.
Saudi Arabia is a much more flawed society in many, many ways than Iranian society is. And so I have long-term hopes for Iran. I have long-term concerns about Saudi Arabia.
Hi. First, thank you very much for you've shared a lot of information, which has given me about 200 or 300 questions. I'll limit them just to a few things. In your book, you touch on resurrecting the draft. We all know people who are going back for their third and fourth deployments, and then their wives say, it's either me or the Army or the Marine Corps or whatever. How do we change that, number one? Number two, in this current administration, there seems to be tremendous interest in resurrecting the Muslim Brotherhood, including having conferences in Washington with no moderate Muslims allowed. How do we change that? And number three, I disagree with you about Russia. Why not bleed them cheaply? The Estonians and the Lithuanians are very worried. The Poles are very worried. They have history to understand why they should be worried. And we have Putin visiting Hungary to remind them that he's not far away. Why should let that guy have a free ride? Thank you.
You want to work back? We can start with the draft. We can do moderate Muslims invited to the White House and Russia. Which do you like?
I'll go backwards, but you have to help me remember.
I'll remember.
You have to help me remember. I didn't take notes. I think there's no easy way to bleed Putin cheaply. I talked about escalation dominance. He cares more about what happens in the Ukraine than we do. So I absolutely agree we should be supporting and reinforcing the Lithuanians, the Estonians, the Poles, all of the NATO members, right, should have more American boots, more American weapons, and the line should be clear. I do not suggest we engage in a covert war against Putin's forces in the Ukraine as we did in Afghanistan. It's too close to him. It's a vital national interest for him, and it's too easy for him to ramp up further than we want to. And also, just quite frankly, there are a lot more important things on the globe. If we have additional resources to spare, we should be reinforcing the people fighting the Islamic State.
Is he not taken as a serious man in Europe and Asia? I mean, is Putin globally taken serious?
Seriously? No. Putin is a thug. Russia is dying.
It seemed globally he was being saluted as the great savior in Syria about a year or two ago.
The change in world energy prices really, really matters, right? When oil was $120 a barrel and there wasn't any prospects for LNG, nuclear liquid natural gas, Europe really needed to pretend Putin mattered. That world has changed. That ship has sailed. The change in energy really affects Putin and the importance of Russia. Russia's dying. Russia's yesterday's news. It can still cause trouble on the fringes of its former empire, but that doesn't really matter to us. There are a lot of things that do.
I'll move to the draft. I want to get all three of his questions and get some more quick. So draft.
So this allows me to talk about something I'm enormously proud of, and we should all be enormously proud of. When we ended the draft in 1973, nobody ever would have imagined that the all-volunteer force could survive one decade of a protracted irregular war, much less a decade and a half of two protracted irregular wars. And in fact, the all-volunteer force is stronger today than it was on September 11th, 2001. It is the most... It is the most battle-tested force the country has ever had. It can be compared only to Rome's legions. They are phenomenal. We made a huge mistake, and I mentioned this earlier, the two critical mistakes of the George W. Bush administration were invading Iraq in 2003, an error of commission, and the error of omission was not mobilizing the nation for war on September 12, 2001. So we should have put a gasoline tax of 50 cents a gallon on September 12th. Everybody in Congress would have voted for it. It becomes a kill the radical Islamic extremists tax, defend freedom tax. I don't care. And we should have used that money to double the size of the U.S. Army. Instead, we kept the size of the Army the same, and we sent the same kids to war over and over and over again. Right. And we're, as I said, we're going to be paying the price for that for generations.
A wartime draft? Is that what you're saying?
No. A wartime tax. We would have had no problem signing up all the kids we needed.
Oh, you mean there we didn't have the funds to sign up the kids?
We just needed money. All we needed was money.
We had plenty of able-bodied, willing kids,
and we still do. And in fact, today we're in the extraordinary position of downsizing our military while we're still fighting all these wars, while we're still in a very dangerous position. And because of the sequester, which is currently the worst thing being done to America today is not being done by Iran or Russia or, frankly, even the Islamic State. It's the sequester, right? We are currently sending pink slips to Army captains serving in combat in Afghanistan, telling them they're being kicked out of the Army. Right? We should be rioting in the streets against our Congress and this administration, neither of which have been able to undo an unbelievably stupid, unbelievably self-defeating, unbelievably damaging set of legislation, right? That should have led the Joint Chiefs of Staff to resign en masse. That's how bad this is, right? So there is no shortage of great young Americans willing to serve this country. There is simply a shortage of dollars in the Department of Defense to do what needs doing. And with the stock market at an all-time high, right, we don't have our priorities straight as Americans. So that really gets me fired.
Is there a lack of presence, moderate Muslim or Islam, moderate Islam? Is there a lack of presence in the White House? Is there a lack of moderate Islamic figures speaking out in the United States? Would you like to see more? I know there was... And it got some traction over the weekend. How many of you saw the ring around the synagogue in Oslo, was it? Did you see that? It was a stirring display. I don't know how prominent that is, that line of thinking. You think it is?
So, no, I think that there is. I think that every moderate Muslim has a responsibility to stand up and say, this will not stand. This is not my religion. This is not what we believe in. And to condemn in the... Right, the strongest possible way, and on the internets and everywhere, to decry these murderers, these people who killed 140 school kids in a Pakistani school, who immolate a Jordanian pilot, a devout Muslim and father of five, the good Muslims who were killed in Iraq, burned alive this week. There is plenty of room for moderate Muslims to say, this is not Islam, and those who practice this are not Muslims. And unfortunately, the Islamic religion doesn't have the grand caliph who speaks for all Muslims, as Catholicism, my tradition, has a pope who, but they've got plenty of caliphs who can speak and who should speak, and we should be seeing those demonstrations to try to defeat the idea that by engaging in jihad, you are serving Allah, when that is absolutely not the case.
I'm going to give this 15 more minutes. We're going to go to 8:30, just so you guys know and have a time frame. So we'll try to get as many as we can quick.
Thank you, of course, for your service. I am with the heroes. Welcome. I do welcome our troops. And I could say our troops, the ones coming home, are willing to go back. Everybody I have met, whether it be their families, when they have fallen, they are willing to go back and fight the good fight. What you're saying is the trumpet is uncertain, and that is the problem. But thank you so much. My question is El-Sisi and Egypt, okay? Egypt is fighting back. They want to fight back. They're buying arms. We've supplied and educated their officers. Our president is alienating them with the Muslim Brotherhood. So now El-Sisi can't do it alone. The Peshmerga can't do it alone. We should have done everything yesterday, as you said. How do we save our country? How do we save the Christians? How do we save the Muslims? What do we do now? How can I, as an individual, do anything? And what can our Congress do to help us? Because we have two more years of a president that doesn't recognize evil.
Arming the Kurds, arming El-Sisi, arming, do you support the idea of not only us lending our own boots on the ground, arming other factions that we deem as moderate or soft allies or whatever you want to call them?
So the way to defeat insurgencies, the way to defeat these threats is by arming, training, equipping moderate forces that respond well to, that work for national governments that we support, Peshmerga. The Kurds is just one example of what we ought to be doing. In fact, I have argued in print, and I was deeply honored when Secretary Defense Gates, the best Secretary of Defense we've ever had, paraphrased me, saying that the most important mission of the American military in this century may not be the fighting we do ourselves, but the way we enable and empower our allies to do the fighting for us. However, right, our well-bearded friend has pointed out the weapons have a habit of leaking away and falling into hands we don't appreciate. I think the best way to prevent that from happening is to embed American advisors inside those units long-term, to use the weapons effectively, to keep an eye on them, to imbue these forces with the patriotism, the dedication to service, as well as the technical skills that you correctly applaud. And so I've advocated for more than a decade now the creation of a standing advisory force for the U.S. military, built out of the Army. A force of 60,000 is the numbers I've recommended. There has been some support for that. Chief of Staff of the Army Ray Odierno wanted to stand up a brigade of that in the National Guard. Again, he was not able to do so. He needed to build one in the inside baseball, but. He doesn't have the money to do anything. And so let me again say, the biggest threat to the United States, the biggest threat to the armed forces of the United States is not any of the enemies we have abroad. We can kill them all. Not an issue. But we are currently downsizing our forces because of the sequester. This is a law passed by our Congress. We currently have Republican majorities in the House and the Senate. They say they support the troops. They should repeal the sequester tomorrow and give the Department of Defense the resources it needs. Once they do that, they can start telling me that I will start believing them when they say they support the troops.
Once again, thanks again for your service. I have just two quick definitions, maybe if you can clarify. I understand that the word Islam means to submit. Okay. I recently learned that they define peace as the absence of dissent. It was a documentary on this weekend, and it mentioned that. That's how they, in that world, that's how they define
the
peace.
Absence of dissent.
Okay. Yeah. So if you could expand on that.
Can you pass the mic? Dory, do you want to take that one? Can you pass the microphone to the man in front of you? So we do have, honestly, a world-class student of Islam. Professor, Dr. President Dory Friend, sir.
John, thanks for lobbing the lateral pass here. I don't know what part of my neighbor's observation you want me to take hold of. I didn't hear what he heard over the weekend, and I don't think that much of Islam oversimplifies peace as meaning absence of dissent. I just don't know what you're referring to. I'm at sea here.
Can you talk a little bit about how the Islamic religion views war and peace, and your sense of the feeling among moderate Muslims toward the radical Islamic jihad? Is that?
And I'll ask you, if I may, I asked him, and I'll ask you, since you've studied this most of your life, the view that most, I shouldn't say most, but many Americans hold, that Islam, just by its very fundamental principles, its core tenets, are all in. Maybe they're not taking up arms, but they don't really have a problem with the kill-slash-convert movement.
I think that's, again, if I may refer to you as Chris... Chris, I think,
or whatever you'd like to call me,
Curly.
That's still a lot better than I hear often. So I'll take Curly.
I think you've greatly oversimplified something else. I've only spent the last 12 years, approximately, not all my life, studying Islam.
More than me.
About 10% of his life.
Whenever I hear these simplifications about Islam, I'm tempted to get into simplifications about Christianity.
Right.
Nugget, most of them unchewable nuggets, in my view, about a world religion that comes down to somebody's in-your-face oversimplification, I think is dangerous. Will all the moderate Christians in this room, I underline moderate Christians, please raise their hands?
Right. Well, that's, you know, but that's almost impossible, as you point out, to identify, really.
Exactly. And will all the radical extremist Christians please raise their hands?
So point taken, just in the interest of time then, point taken, yeah. I don't disagree with it. I would just ask you then, are there enough folks saying what you're saying that represent Islam, in your view? Are there enough vocal, prominent folks to step up and say, hey, you're oversimplifying our faith?
There are a lot of them saying it. There are almost no American media people picking it up. Our media keep telling us, where are the moderate Muslims?
Who would you recommend, sincerely? Is there someone we could go read about tonight?
I know Indonesia best among five Muslim countries I know pretty well. There are two recently deceased, highly articulate, I would say, moderate Muslims, mm-hmm. Abdurrahman Wahid and Nurholish Majid.
Might have to get those spellings.
Right. But let's talk about live people. Track what the current president of Indonesia is doing. He may have lots of trouble. So-called Jokowi, Joko Widodo. He rose from being a local politician in Central Java and has made him, has arisen to be, president of a nation of 240 million people.
Now, so Indonesia is where you'd say we could focus, for instance, if we're seeking moderate voices in Islam, Indonesia is a good start.
Indonesia and to a considerable degree, I would add, Tunisia, even though they've got a lot of problems that they're dealing with and a lot of strife that hits the newspapers. But there's no want of people, and no lack of countries in the Islamic world that have nothing to do with, as a point you've made, Chris, and John has made it also quite strongly, have nothing to do with ISIS. Nothing. Mm-hmm. ISIS is being fed partly by, in our minds, by our media.
Yeah.
They're dangerous enough. Thugs, they're wackos, they're religious fanatics of the worst kind. They're loathsome, but they're not ultimately, in my view, 10, 20 years down the pike dangerous.
Okay,
they will
you.
Be exposed, in my view, and John may disagree. I invite his disagreement. I'll toss this.
I don't want to cut you off. I just want to get a couple more questions in before we're out of time. So thank you, sir, very much. I do appreciate your perspective on it very much.
The document, my source, is by Stephen Emerson, who you're probably familiar with. He appears on Fox as a terrorism expert. And the show was, it was www.granddeception.com.
You two ought to meet later.
Yeah, that's right. So in general, anyone who is billed as an expert isn't.
Well, now, you know what? I'm sorry. On that point, I meant to bring this up to you. There are an awful lot of military men and women like you on cable news every day. And when stories like this pop up, there's no shortage on any cable show of men like you with the title Colonel, General, Lieutenant Colonel. What are we? And so often, because of that, our reverence for men and women that serve, I'm inclined to say, well, they got to know what they're talking about. Who am I? I've never done it. They have, so I'll defer to them. What do you say to that? Including you, for that matter.
Absolutely, including me. So when I am referred to as an expert, I always respond that I am a student of something, but I am not an expert. And I am not, and I do not consider myself to be a particularly good student of Islam, as I just demonstrated by lobbing that to Dory. I am a longtime student of counterinsurgency and have studied that for well over a decade now, less than 10% of my life. So I recently, Lieutenant General Dan Bolger, very talented general, PhD from University of Chicago in military history, taught at West Point as I did. Dan has just written a book called Why We Lost, a general's inside account of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Dan and I debated each other at the University of Virginia's Miller Center last month, and you can find it on the interwebs, but disagreed very strongly on right. I argue that we have not lost either in Iraq or in Afghanistan, and in fact that Afghanistan in particular is likely to turn out to be a reasonable success story if we don't mess up the end game as we messed up the end game in Iraq, an unforced error of the worst kind. But so you've got two, right, PhD military historian army officers who've served. Both served in combat numerous times, disagreeing with each other. So credentials are insufficient to render someone an expert. You need to listen hard to what they say, evaluate their argument on its merits, see how they engage with people they disagree with, and then come to your own decisions and your own analysis. But the soundbite journalism that Dory decries doesn't lend itself to a deep understanding of the issues, and that's right. That's one of the reasons why I was so pleased to get the chance to have this extended discussion with all of you this evening.
I'll do one more. Now, I should ask you, though, can people here email you if they have a question? I don't know what kind of your... I mean, I'm sure you're not going to be able to sit down and respond right away, but, I mean, if people really want to follow up and ask you something, what's the best way? Can they reach out to you in any way? Read your book, obviously, Knife Fights. Well, you all have a copy.
Absolutely.
That's a no. That's fine. That, you that's can say no. No. I'm busy. I mean, no,
for God's sake. For God's sake.
Leave me alone. You got me tonight. That's
I'm,
it.
I'm right. Well, I hope I hope I'll continue to talk on Chris's show. It's not just the book. I've published on this a bunch, including the Counterinsurgency Field Manual. I've done a whole bunch of media. An enormous amount of John Nagle out there, more than anybody could possibly want. But feel free to take a look and remember how I bill myself. Right, I'm a longtime student of counterinsurgency. I am not, by no means, am I an expert on the Islamic world.
One more. Who wants it?
Thank you. We have both Eating Soup and this book, and they're very different, but both excellent. This copy's going to our younger son, who in a couple of years will be a newly commissioned second lieutenant. What advice would you give to a young second lieutenant with your scholarly as well as practical soldiering knowledge at this point in history?
Is he, what commissioning source? Where is he now?
ROTC is a scholarship student at Penn State.
At Penn State, that's fantastic. I was
last week Provo, Utah at BYU and got to work with the extraordinary best Air Force ROTC detachment in America in Provo, so they told me, and their Army ROTC program. Next week, I'm at Cal Berkeley as a guest of the Navy ROTC program there. And one of the really fun things about being able to wander around and talk about knife fights and talk about the wars of the last decades has been going to places to meet the next generation of soldiers and scholars at places like that to talk to. A few weeks ago, I was on your show, actually, the morning I was flying out. I talked to the Combat Aviation Brigade of the 101st Airborne in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. They were just back from a year in Afghanistan. And so, as I talk to an audience of Americans, let me tell you, the country is going to be just fine, right? I'm not sold on the political leadership we've had this century of either party. I do think that the choices we're going to be presented in 16 are both going to be more balanced, more centrist, more likely to make the right calls than either president we've had so far this century. And so I'm long-term enormously hopeful about this country for any number of reasons. Our demographics, we're continuing to grow, largely because of immigration. We continue to attract the most talented people from around the globe. I often cite the important Army training film, Stripes, the Bill Murray movie, right? Remember, we're Americans, our ancestors were kicked out of every decent country in the globe, right? That continues to be the case. We continue to attract the cream from around the globe, and despite its flaws, we still have the best government system in the world, allows innovation, encourages innovation, right? Great kids at schools like Haverford, great young people at schools like Penn State who are fighting hard. There aren't enough active duty commissions to go around for all of the kids in ROTC programs. The kids are elbowing each other in the throat to get active duty commissions because they want to go fight for their country. God bless them. And so we're going to be fine. The second lieutenants need to be able to do two things. Army, awesome. So lieutenants need to be able to do two things better than anybody else in their unit. And I was a brand new, when I was a brand new lieutenant, reporting to my tank platoon in the desert of Saudi Arabia, getting ready to go kick Saddam out of Iraq. They were all pretty much all older than I was. They certainly all knew how to tank better than I did. There were two things that I needed to be able to do better than any of them. I needed to be able to do more push-ups and run faster than they could, and I needed to be able to write better than they could. Because they could make the tanks go, they could make the tanks point in the right direction, they could make sure that we shot the tanks that didn't look like ours. They took care of all of that stuff for me. The thing they couldn't do was write award narratives afterwards to get everybody the medals they deserved. And so my ability to write in complete sentences, and he's at Penn State, So you know, maybe, right? Right? Was the most important attribute I brought to that platoon. They were great Americans. The your sons and daughters out there serving in units and preparing to serve our country are great as well. The country's gonna be just fine. Be strong.
You know, yes, sure. Go ahead. I say it often on the show, and I mean it from the depths of my soul, that I'm so grateful to you for being here and for listening to the show, and I am equally as grateful to have the privilege in this line of work to meet men like this. So to you and to Dr. Noggle, I thank all of you very much for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it, learned as much as I did, and thank you very much for listening. Drive safely. Good night.